طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Many times on This Week in Palestine, we have discussed the weaponization of anti-Semitism as a way for Israeli proponents to silence and punish those who dare criticize Israel. Our featured speaker today, reporter Max Blumenthal, uses his investigative skills to document the abuse of the anti-Semitism accusation used to denigrate and delegitimize critics of Israel's colonization and occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. He discusses it with Nora Barrows Friedman on an Electronic Intifada podcast, which, because of its length, we unfortunately had to edit down to meet our time limit. So, here is Max Blumenthal in conversation with Nora Barrows Friedman.
We're thrilled to have our good friend and colleague Max Blumenthal join us once again. Max is the editor of The Gray Zone. He's the co-host of Moderate Rebels and the author of many crucial books, including The Management of Savagery, The 51-Day War, and Goliath. Max, thanks so much for coming back on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks for bringing me back.
Let's start with the investigation that you just published on The Gray Zone about the manufactured anti-Semitism instances that seem to be popping up all over, not just the U.S., but in Canada and in Europe. The title of your article is "To Distract from Gaza's Slaughter, Israel Lobby Manufactures Anti-Semitism Freakout." Asa, you were following this a lot too, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a kind of global phenomenon. Yeah. So in your newest piece, you explain how the Israel lobby manufactured a rash of anti-Semitic violence in order to smear the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And this is your piece on The Gray Zone that Nora mentioned. So could you explain what you found when you investigated this for our viewers who may not have read the piece, and just get into what you concluded?
Well, yeah, Asa, you've been doing these kinds of investigations ever since, at least since Jeremy Corbyn came on the scene, because the distortions and deceptions are very similar. What the British Israel lobby wanted to do was paint Corbyn and everyone around him as an anti-Semite. And they would often create these confrontations, or create them with, you know, for example, Ken Livingstone or people around him, to give the British public the impression that something was very wrong, and that somehow a Nazi had slipped through and not a veteran anti-racist. And what they're doing in the U.S. is basically trying to find an exit ramp from the scenes that even CNN was showing of media towers in Gaza being taken out for no reason other than the fact that the Israelis were a frustrated Goliath, or entire families being exterminated, and to replace the victimhood of Palestinians with that of one of the most affluent, entitled, hyper-privileged demographic groups on the planet, American Jews. And so they did it by using deceptively edited video, video without context, a pile of allegations that couldn't be substantiated, just to create a general atmosphere of hysteria. And of course, corporate media played along, partly for ratings and partly because the longstanding sympathy of the kind of personnel that fill the management of corporate media outlets for Israel and their longstanding relationship with the main organization behind this narrative, which was the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, better known as the Arab Defamation League or the Defamation League, because all they do is defame Arabs. So what I did was like Bellingcat dweebs call OSINT, and they try to make their craft seem so sophisticated and so vital, like it's this vital form of journalism, but OSINT, open source intelligence
on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. Like you look at video and study it and examine it, or you study Google Earth images or whatever, tweets, Facebook pages. Yeah, finding things on the internet. It's like stuff we used to do before they existed, and I always thought of it as like a kind of crude form of journalism that you do when you can't be in the field or you're not actually working with documents. And I didn't get documents from intelligence agencies, by the way, but that's beside the point. So I just looked at the videos that of the high profile incidents. There was one video in particular that Don Lemon on CNN, big, pro-Israel loudmouth host of CNN, was constantly showing. And he had this young man, this 23-year-old from Long Island who had come into New York City, said he was attacked by a mob of Palestinians because he was wearing a kippah, a Jewish skull cap. And Lemon would show this mob beating this guy. Yeah, he was getting a beat down. One guy hit him with a crutch and it looked bad, but I watched the full video and the guy was wearing a gray hoodie, which covered his head at all times. In the video, there were clear photographs of the incident afterwards showing that his head was completely covered. There was no way to know that he was Jewish. So clearly something had happened to precipitate this conflict. What's more, this guy, Joseph Borgen, actually, after getting hit a few times on the ground, got up and had to be held back by cops as he attempted to charge at the people who were hitting him and challenging them to fight. So he was really aggressive. Like if I were just walking down the street and someone committed a hate crime against me out of nowhere, I wouldn't be getting up and trying to fight them after some cops came and rescued me. So I gathered witness testimony. The witness testimony corroborated the witness testimony I saw buried in media reports of the incident, which was that pro-Israel demonstrators on their way to a pro-Israel demonstration actually attacked the Palestinian young men on their way to a Palestine solidarity demonstration, both in Midtown New York, with the Israelis planning theirs in a very, in a location where they would make sure they were near the Palestinians. And there were media reports of pro-Israel elements throwing bottles of juice and water out the window at Palestinians and their supporters as they marched by. So you basically have a story that's 180 degrees different than the official version of events, which was conveyed to the American public about Jews just being beaten down. And, I can go through incident after incident. They all follow the same pattern, but it got to a point where Joseph Biden, the president, and Kamala Harris, the vice president, denounced this wave of anti-Semitism. And it really creates the perception among at least some sector of Jewish Americans that they're under siege and that they need an Israel to protect them or a place to go take shelter. And when in fact, the reality is in the UK and the US, we're living in a golden age. We're much better off than Jews are in Israel. That is the least safe place for Jews to be. It's also a place where Jews are conscripted at age 18 into an apartheid army to carry out the warehousing and even extermination of an indigenous population. So that's why this narrative is so not just false, but dangerous and insidious. And it's nice to actually see lots of people, including more mainstream segments of the Jewish left than I represent, actually calling it out.
It was interesting too, because it followed the exact same pattern that the, you know, how the media covered the attacks on Gaza as though the clock started when, you know, the Palestinian Resistance Forces fired rockets into Jerusalem. When, you know, when you pull back the camera and you look at the macro situation, of course, that's not when the clock started. Israel is always the aggressor. Israel always is the perpetrator. Kind of talk a little bit about how just these kind of mechanisms of like presenting these stories completely devoid of any historical or factual context. If there's any change to perception now, I feel like after the attacks in May, there has been more of skepticism and criticism of not just Israel and Israeli policy, but of the U.S.'s support of it. Do you see any relationship between the two?
Well, just to address the first part of your point, David Sheen, longtime EI contributor and Israeli Canadian journalist living in Haifa, wrote a really important piece for us at the Gray Zone on how Netanyahu's coalition was hanging by a thread. In order to construct the coalition, he brought in these Kahanists, the extreme right of the far right of like the already right wing Israeli political spectrum.
The right of the right.
Exactly.
The right of the far right.
I mean, it's what the Israeli philosopher Yeshayahu Leibovich would have called Judeo-Nazis. That's essentially what they are. These very characters, I've followed them and filmed them rioting against Africans in Tel Aviv. They do that in the South Hebron Hills. We know who they are. Everyone watching this knows who they are. And they were brought into the government by Netanyahu. And then they were kind of turned loose around Jerusalem when Netanyahu needed a war to stave off what we see happening now, which is his coalition completely collapsing. And they gave him the war that they wanted, that he wanted, by provoking Palestinians all around Jerusalem and generating a military a militarized response by the police around the Al-Aqsa compound. These were the events that precipitated what took place in Gaza. And, you know, as I think John Elmer pointed it out in one of your last podcasts, that the resistance factions in Gaza were actually, you know, breaking out of their ghetto and sending a message to Israel over Jerusalem. This war began over Jerusalem, not over the siege in Gaza. So that's what precipitated the war. And yes, it was all edited out of the mainstream media narrative in the U.S., which we saw consisted of Israel versus Hamas. That's how NPR, the Washington Post, the New York Times framed it. The Israeli-Hamas conflict, that's what they called it. But it was really much more of a Palestinian-wide uprising on all levels across Palestinian society, across walls, across all these militarized barriers that Israel's constructed than we have seen at any time since the Second Intifada. So it really was, Jewish-Israeli, the Jewish-Israeli military versus Palestinian society. That's what was taking place. And David made an interesting point about my article in one section in particular, where there were these two Israelis who said that they were attacked in Times Square, or sorry, in Midtown East for speaking Hebrew. They were set upon by a Palestinian mob that happened to be kind of marching down the street just because they heard them speaking Hebrew. The reality in the video shows that one of the Israelis is holding an Israeli flag in his hand and starts punching Palestinians and initiates the violence. And then he begins to taunt them, chanting, "Long live the state of Israel," as cops are dragging him away. They arrested him because he initiated the violence. And it turns out that these two characters were Golani Brigade veteran soldiers who had served in the 2014 assault on Gaza, in which 551 children were killed. After the assault, they started a GoFundMe headlined with pictures of themselves in the thumbnail image punching Palestinians in Midtown, raising money for the Golani Brigade, but they went on Fox News portraying themselves as victims of a hate crime. Then they went to Hebrew language media in Israel on a far right network or right wing network, bragging to the host about how many Palestinians they punched. The host was celebrating them as these Jewish lions who were not like the weak-hearted liberal Jews of America. And David said that's the Israeli society's entire narrative about what took place in Lod, for example, or Haifa, where there were Bat Yam, these mixed cities where mobs of Jewish extremists were brought in under police protection to assault Palestinians. And then Jews were portrayed as the victims of these assaults in the kind of official story. But privately, everyone was like, yeah, we hurt them good. So it was a perfect microcosm for the narrative of Israeli society. I mean, and their narrative is so divorced from what anyone who uses social media sees. So I think that's right. Where that was kind of the firewall for a lot of, I would say, progressives in the US, including people who are on the fence, who are not already like EI or Mondo Weiss or Gray Zone readers, like people who were questioning this. They would see footage produced by Palestinian journalists in the Gaza Strip, tweeted out by young people in Gaza who speak perfect English. You know, they'd gone to the UN schools and they understand social media. And really, Twitter has advanced a lot since 2014. The audience is much wider. You can use more characters. It's easier to use video. So the documentation of this assault was much more vivid on Twitter, Instagram, everywhere than it had been in the past. And I think this provided a sort of it transcended whatever the Israel lobby was trying to convey in mainstream media, or the limitations of the New York Times, which kind of is getting hailed for featuring all these murdered children on its cover, but which still conveyed pretty much the official narrative or the typical liberal Zionist line that most of its correspondents uphold throughout the 11 days of fighting around Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was very clear during the time that Israel's always been Israel, and its military and its defenders and its advocates have always been the ultimate aggressors posing as the victims. And, you know, I didn't see this covered very widely in mainstream media, but what you were talking about with extremist Jewish Israeli armed militias inside cities in present day Israel were organizing themselves en masse in hundreds over social media, over internal instant messaging applications like WhatsApp and Telegram. And this was being done either with them relying on the passive support of Israeli authorities or on the outright support of Israeli authorities. And there are these two Israeli liberal groups who kind of infiltrated all of these messaging groups, which contained hundreds. And it's also contained settlers who lived in Jewish-only colonies in the occupied West Bank, who were planning and actually did arrive in Israeli cities in buses to attack Palestinians. And, you know, these two groups that infiltrated those internal messaging apps where people were organizing themselves into armed militias found some of the most vile correspondence between these groups. You know, just you cannot make this stuff up, like exchanging pictures of weapons, exchanging threats, talking about wanting to break Palestinian bones. There was one message that I'll never forget that said, you know, it was all in Hebrew, but we did the translations of it, and it said, today we are Nazis. Today we are no longer Jews. We are Nazis. And there's just something so perverse that is happening right in front of everyone's eyes. And I understand that it's always been either the right or the extreme right in Israel, but I truly feel like there's a move to even go further than that. The society is just going so extremist and so right-wing And we're seeing that with the new Bennett-Lapid rotation now.
Yeah, one of the things that I mean, that line really stuck with me too from your piece that you wrote with our colleague Eliab and Nima Tamara about the Judeo-Nazis, you know, really. I mean, look, I mean, this is really a theme. You mentioned, Max, earlier my work on the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn and the bogus anti-Semitism allegations against them over the years. And one of the recurring themes in that was this attempted ban on any kind of raising of the word Nazi in the context of Israel, you know, any kind of historical comparison or anything like that. And, you know, that's been enshrined in the so-called EUMC working definition of the working definition of anti-Semitism by the IHRA. You know, that you're not supposed to make these kind of, you're not supposed to mention the Nazis. Don't mention the Germans. But like, I mean, again, this is another example of reality contradicting, you know, reality violates this definition, you know.
Well, they're violating. Yeah, you have Zionists calling them violating the IHRA
right.
definition.
Yeah, they this is their words, you know. It's not are we not yeah. supposed to report the truth, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if the ADL is going to condemn that.
I mean, it's sort of considered offensive to mention Leni Brenner's book on 51 documents of Zionist Nazi collaboration. This is a sort of blue collar historian, Leni Brenner. He was, affiliated with a lot of kind of Trotskyist socialist groups. He was the treasurer for Stokely Carmichael for a time. I got to meet him once, and he put together a book with the title that I just cited. And it's just documents that provide evidence of collaboration between the Zionist movement and Nazi Germany. And there was a relationship or a marriage of convenience between the labor wing of Zionism and Nazi Germany to bring Jewish people and property over and allow the German government of Adolf Hitler to take a portion, to take a cut, and to basically bypass and eliminate, destroy the Jewish global boycott of Nazi Germany. American Zionist groups were basically told, stop boycotting Nazi Germany. And, because, you know, they're helping us out in historic Palestine, build this state that we're dreaming of. And, you know, Hitler himself was very aware of this relationship. You had people in the Jewish office working under Eichmann, like Leopold von Mildenstein, who was actually taking tours of the kibbutzim and very admiring of what the Zionist movement was doing in Palestine. He said the Trumpeldorians, referring to Joseph Trumpeldor, one of the heroes of Likudnik Zionism or revisionist Zionism, are very similar to us, the brown shirts, and their connection to the blood and soil of their movement. And so when von Mildenstein actually returned to Germany from this trip he took of kibbutzim, he received a medallion. On one side was, unfortunately, the Star of David that the Zionist movement had co-opted as its symbol. And on the other side was a swastika, the symbol of the Nazi party. And when I met Leni Brenner, he actually had brought this medallion, which he managed to pick up at a auction. And it was just so disturbing. It felt like when I held it in my hand, it felt like I was holding something that was 1,000 degrees, and it was like burning in my hand. It was just so disturbing to actually see it. This relationship was not just political or economic. There was a ideological dimension to it. The Stern Gang that ultimately produced Yitzhak Shamir as prime minister, he was one of their leaders. The Stern Gang that assassinated Volki Bernadotte because he attempted to organize the return of Palestinian refugees who had been cleansed in 1948 as UN special representative to the Holy Land. The Stern Gang that carried out the Deryasin massacre in 1933 when Hitler was rose to power. He wasn't actually elected, but when he rose to power, the Stern Gang issued a letter pledging or offering a sort of strategic partnership and pledging to establish a fascist Jewish theocracy in the Holy Land. I mean, nothing really came of that, but it shows that there's an ideological dimension to all of this. And it's more complex than indicating. The revisionist Zionists assassinated Haimar Lossaroff, who was the second in charge of the labor Zionist movement. He was in charge of the Jewish agency because he was overseeing that transfer agreement with Nazi Germany that I mentioned before. So there were elements of the revisionist movement that were opposed to all of this, but there was still a mutual shared affinity. Now you flash forward to the contemporary era of Zionism, where Kahanism, the movement that reveres Meir Kahana, this fascist rabbi who was killed, who basically helped popularize or gave voice to the feeling in Israeli society that Palestinians should all be ethnically cleansed, that there should be sort of a second Nakba, and that a Jewish exclusivist theocratic state should be established that would just kind of end the whole situation of negotiation once and for all. The mainstreaming of this movement really created the context for what we saw take place in these mixed cities. And I remember, you know, I was staying when I was working on Goliath back in like, I started work on it in like 2009, and I was staying in Jaffa in 2010. And I was actually kind of getting the sense that these elements, these Kahanist elements, were starting to operate in the area, particularly like 10 or 15 minutes south in Bat Yam, which was a mixed area where a lot of Russian and Mizrahi lower and lower middle class Jews were living among Palestinians. And there was a lot of tension, and the Kahanists were coming in from the West Bank and from the extremist settlements and attempting to basically pour lighter fluid on those simmering flames. I was reading their newsletter that they would put it out online, and they had like operation, I forget what they called it, like seal the locks or something, but they would target Palestinian homes by filling their locks with glue and cement to make it impossible for them to get back in their houses. And this is the kind of thing they were doing to try to turn up the heat in these areas. It's something they're doing all across Palestine, but particularly in areas inside Israel. And like, this is the context to the context of this latest escalation. So what we saw there was totally expected, with basically a night of broken glass in Bat Yam, where these extremist mobs, many of them were settlers who came in from the West Bank, were smashing the glass storefronts of Palestinian businesses. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you know the businessmen and you know that class, they really are very uncomfortable with any form of protest against occupation. They're always trying to maintain good relations with the Jewish majority just to secure their place. And yet they still got attacked. People were beaten. Oren Ziv, the photojournalist from Active Stills, he actually documented pretty clearly how the police were directly working with these mobs. And the function these mobs played was actually kind of as a paramilitary, like what we see in Colombia right now, where the bike police are a little bit overstretched. So they bring in just groups of plainclothes thugs who've been filmed shooting protesters in the streets.
The deputy mayor of Lid actually described them in that way. Like he said they were volunteers coming in from the West Bank. I believe that was his exact word, right? Is that right, Tamara?
Yeah, volunteers. Yes.
He said they were coming to protect Jewish homes, and that he advises all Palestinian citizens to remain in their homes because they're coming to help out. They're coming to protect Jewish homes in Israel.
I mean, and the security forces, if you can call them that, you want to call them the apartheid maintenance forces, that might be more accurate. They were overstretched because of what was happening in Jerusalem, because of what was beginning to take form in and around Gaza. And the pressure on the Israeli leadership to completely suppress this uprising inside 48 Palestine or Israel was enormous. This is really the ultimate fear of the Jewish Israeli public. It's very similar to the fear of the Southern agrarian class during the 1850s, particularly after John Brown's organized uprising around Harper's Ferry of a massive, or Nat Turner's uprising of a massive slave revolt in an area where they're basically outnumbered. That fear has led to violence in the past. It's led to the killing of 13 demonstrators around Malfahim and Haifa in 2000. And the same thing happened. Ehud Barak was prime minister then, and he met with all the security principals and he said, you have a green light to do whatever's necessary. Netanyahu took it to another level. He staged a nationally televised press conference with the security chiefs behind him. And he said, you have a green light to do whatever's necessary. And there's not going to be a commission of inquiry. He was referring to the Ora Commission that investigated the killing of those 13 demonstrators in 2000 and found that the Israeli government was systematically discriminating against Palestinian citizens. Netanyahu's like, none of that's going to happen. Just go for it. Bring in the thugs, let the dogs out, do whatever's necessary. So, I mean, and that's what, thanks to social media, we were able to see how vicious the suppression was. And it's ongoing as we speak, you know, as you've been reporting at EI with the mass arrest of hundreds of young people.
In your piece, just to kind of circle back, you report on how Palestine Solidarity and leftist or progressive groups, instead of debunking, questioning, or even asking for any evidence, instinctively responded and continue to do so by condemning anti-Semitism, despite there being little or no evidence of it. You know, this is what Corbyn fell victim to, instead of like completely dismissing this charge of anti-Semitism, he, you know, began apologizing for it. Why is this so dangerous? And you know, what should Palestine Solidarity activists be doing instead of, you know, kind of playing into this like Israel lobby tactic of trying to make everything anti-Semitism?
Well, there was a active campaign among the kind of like NGO wing of some element of Palestine Solidarity on Twitter to basically apologize for a wave of anti-Semitism that didn't exist, along with, I saw a lot of tweets sort of simultaneously denouncing the Assadists in our ranks, or maybe they meant the Assadists. I think they were referring to Assadists, who basically people who opposed regime change in Syria.
Yeah, that was very interesting. Like, that was happening. I mean, at exactly the moment Gaza was being bombed, these sort of...
Well,
I mean, it wasn't a lot of people, but it was like a few very vocal people on Twitter who used that exact moment to sort of say, oh, if you're retweeting or, you know, posting articles from any of the following, you are XYZ, you know. It was very interesting timing, let's say.
It always seems to come at the wrong time, or for them, the right time, at a time of unprecedented unity around Palestine, or we're kind of coming back into this moment of unity. Let's divide everyone again over the most divisive, or one of the most divisive issues. But they're not, I don't think they're thinking that way. As with the anti-Semitism charge, this class of activists is always appealing to elite influence and authority, and trying to demonstrate their worthiness to Western and particularly American elites. And their entire campaign around Palestine hinges on acceptance by those elements, that someday we will be accepted in Congress, or we will be accepted by mainstream media, and they will make room for us and provide representation. The New York Times will have a good Muslim columnist who cares about Palestinians, and then the situation will be resolved. Who needs like all those like bearded Shia guys who are providing Gaza resistance factions with the know-how and weapons to actually hit back? That's uncouth. That's their mentality, and that mentality is, I mean, I think it was repudiated this time by a lot of people, a majority within the movement, who were like, they're trying to criminalize us. We saw what happened in the UK. We are not going to apologize for having rallies and chanting Intifada. And that is what the ADL was demanding.
Yeah.
If you actually look at their report, the ADL's report, where they lay out their case that there's a wave of anti-Semitism and an uptick of anti-Semitic incidents because of the what they called the Israel-Hamas conflict, there's no there there. They're literally defining rallies across the country as anti-Semitic incidents. And so why allow them to define you as an anti-Semite and then criminalize you? In the UK, I think getting hundreds of thousands of people out in the street to demonstrate for Palestine was, of course, it was about the defending the basic humanity of Palestinians who were being exterminated and dispossessed. It was about asserting international law. It was about opposing apartheid, but it was also about defending the democratic rights that are under complete assault by the Israel lobby and its allies among the British elite, and saying we are here and we're not going to be criminalized for basically being decent, moral people who are sick of your little imperial schemes.
Yeah, it was very similar in the UK. Like, as you mentioned, one weekend during the war, there was 150,000 demonstrating in London, and there was demonstrations all over the UK as well. And then the following weekend, there was 200,000 people demonstrating in London, filling up Hyde Park. And again, demonstrations all over the UK.
Well, it's even after the ceasefire too,
It carried on after the ceasefire. There was activists who did sit-ins on top of Elbit factories, the Israeli weapons manufacturers, and this unprecedented moment of unity. And then these kind of different sabotage strategies are coming in. And someone from Dave Rich of the Community Security Trust, which is this the Israel lobby group essentially, but it fulfills quite a similar role in the UK as the ADL, quite a similar group in some ways. He actually tweeted a photo. It's funny you mentioned about Intifada, because he tweeted a photo from a demonstration. I forget exactly what he said, but it was a photo of a sign that just said "Victory to the Intifada." I think it was. It was something about Intifada. And he said, "This is Jew hatred on the streets of London," you know. Yeah. So you know, it was exactly the same MO.
And what? Look at the pro-Israel rallies in and around London. I mean, who was there? Tommy Robinson.
Right. Yeah,
he was like the star of the show. He comes in, everyone's taking selfies with him. It's like, you know,
this is who they're left with. This is the thing. Yeah. Like, there was rumors going around, and I could mention this is rumors, but unable to verify them. But there was people online saying that, and this is Zionists who were saying it, like pro-Israel people who were saying it. They reckoned that Tommy Robinson was actually invited by some of the organizers of the demonstration to make up the numbers. And I'm on the Zionist Federation's newsletter. I just read in it today that they were saying that people came from all around the country to attend the demonstration.
Yeah.
So they were bussing people in, and still they only got, press reports said 1500 people. So it wasn't very many people.
I mean, even if I were some pro-Israel, if I really believed in Israel, I wouldn't have shown up at one of these demos. It's like a time of shame. It's Chuck Schumer, who called himself Charles Schomer, the protector of Israel at one point. He hasn't said a word about this. Nobody wants to say anything. No one's piping up to defend Israel. It's kind of a moment of hanging your head. So, of course, if you're going to fill up your rally, it's going to be like the BNP and EDL and Tommy Robinson. Like, those are the people that are going to come out. In the US, the largest pro-Israel rallies were in Los Angeles. And that's where the most fervently, almost fascistic pro-Israel elements live. And their rallies were the rallies just looked absurd to any rational person. The one mass.
Aren't they going down sign, Rodeo Drive or something, like, you know?
Yeah,
that video was
in
mad.
Beverly Hills. Yeah,
like, who are you appealing to? Like, I commented on Twitter themselves. That I thought it seemed was that supposed to be like a threat against Paris Hilton or something? You know,
it was just a way of us showing how oppressed they are in Beverly Hills.
It's crazy.
Actually,
Max, one of the things I really liked, and it was a great piece, and we'll link to it. One of the things that stood out to me was a bit towards the beginning where you're quoting from the official Israel account, where it's saying, to all our Jewish brothers and sisters around the world, we see you, we hear you, we stand with you. And they posted a blue square in clear imitation of the black square, Black Lives Matter movement. Which was criticized by some people, you know, in itself anyway. But very clearly, they're trying to sort of copy and co-opt this kind of movement. And I really like the way you put it in the piece where you said, the Israel Foreign Ministry has capitalized on the moral panic of alleged anti-Semitism with a tweet invoking the intersectional social justice lexicon of woke millennials.
And Zoomers, I guess.
Yeah.
That really shows you how hollow that kind of language is and how easily co-opted it is, because whether it's by the Israeli Foreign Ministry or the CIA with its sort of woke recruitment ad, the language can be easily transferred to support imperialism or Zionism. And I always said Zionism is the terminal fit. It's the sort of terminal stage or a sort of, it's kind of like right-wing woke politics. It is basically woke politics for right-wing Jewish supremacists.
This is something we saw a lot, again, in the Labour Party, the campaign against Corbyn, where there was a lot of invocation of this kind of language to sort of say, by these people who called themselves Labour Zionists or left-wing Zionists, to say, oh, well, Zionism is just self-determination for the Jewish people, you know, and, you know, oh, a Jew is saying this, so you should believe us, you know, that this is anti-Semitism. We know anti-Semitism when we see it. And, you know, you can't question that. If you question that, then you are anti-Semitic. And it just became this self-perpetuating fantasy that was, I mean, the people who did this were really a minority within a minority, but there was this kind of inordinate fear that this successfully generated, you know, and people were really intimidated by it.
I mean, it's intimidating to take on the identitarian arguments of people who are pushing, for example, when people are pushing regime change in Syria, which is a goal that the
neo-conservatives- Listen to Syrians.
Then listen to Syrian voices. And of course, the voices of people in West Aleppo, where the majority of Aleppans live, or the people in Damascus, or the loyalist population, which simply is the majority right now, they don't count. And they're fascists anyway. But it's intimidating if you're not a Syrian and somebody comes out who's like in, you know, at SOAS or whatever, and they say, I'm a Syrian, shut up, like, we know better than you, then you have to shut up. That's the kind of identitarian argument that's been, or tactic that's been used for several years. It really has been effective on Twitter, which is where the most people, where you see a lot of the political confrontation and one-on-one arguments. And, you know, it's effective in open letters also to try to shut down a critique of anti-imperialist critique. I think it's sort of, it's being exposed right now as the the same tactics are being employed by white imperialist oppressors.
Yeah, I mean, like you conclude in the piece, I mean, this really is kind of what it represents with what's been going on recently in the Palestine Solidarity Movement in North America. It represents a kind of Corbynization, really. And they're trying to, Ali always says, they're trying to do a Corbyn on, they tried to do a Corbyn on Bernie Sanders in the event, you know, he didn't win the primary anyway. And now they're trying to expand the tactic more widely. I mean, you conclude in the piece, we are all Jeremy Corbyn now. And I think that's accurate. You know, there's a real kind of push. It was successful. Like, it wasn't successful in the maximal goal of persuading people to support Israel, people on the left to support Israel. If anything, it had the opposite effect of that long term. But it was really successful in its really primary goal, which was to sabotage the movement. It really it did divide people and it intimidated people. And Corbyn didn't become prime minister, you know.
Yeah. And I thought it was inevitable from the beginning. I was surprised he did so well in 2017, but that was because, I mean, I think the anti-Semitism issue is not what cost Jeremy Corbyn the red wall. It's not what cost Jeremy Corbyn so many votes, but it is what demoralized people in the inner circle of his movement.
And also the grassroots of the movement. The foot soldiers who went door to door. Just talking to people, they weren't there in 2019 to the extent that they were in 2017 because people were so demoralized at being expelled from the Labour Party or driven out from the Labour Party.
I think it's what created space for this kind of metropolitan professional consultant class to come in and say, you need to revise the Brexit vote and you need to start listening to us instead of listening to your own constituents. And that's what led to the collapse. But it's just a good case study in never giving an inch to pro-Israel forces, never give an inch to your adversaries, whether they're imperialists, pro-Israel forces, woke imperialists, whatever they are. If you give them an inch, they will take a mile and they will never accept an apology. No matter a good faith apology, they always act in bad faith. So you just have to look at the situation as it is. You have to hold on to your version of reality and defend it at all costs. And I was a little bit concerned before I started producing a series of tweets that provided the architecture for this investigation that maybe I would get it wrong. Maybe there were some serious anti-Semitic attacks where Jews were attacked as Jews, and then I would, you know, be humiliated and have to issue some kind of apology. And I studied the issue. I mean, I just looked closely at all of these incidents and I felt confident coming out and saying, this is utter bullshit. This is what they did in the UK. And I'm willing to defend that, but other people face harsher consequences than I do. Because they're not Jewish. If you're Palestinian in the US, it's much harder to come out and say this, but you have to be willing to hold on to your version of reality because you're not dealing with good faith actors. You're dealing with people who literally want to criminalize your right to defend your rights.
You have been listening to Gray Zone investigative reporter Max Blumenthal in conversation with Nora Barrow Friedman of the Electronic Intifada. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time on Place on your radio dial. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound engineer, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.